IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now let's listen to Brother Muhammad Al-Hilli, who's going to talk about today's topic.
There are a number and a countless narratives from the life of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far, salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi, in the idea that the religion of Islam is not a religion of individualism. It's not a religion of monasticism. It's not a religion that practices or advocates celibacy, whereby an individual lives like a hermit and isolates themselves. The religion of Islam encourages community service, social activeness. The religion of Islam, when it comes to the Holy Quran, over 200 verses, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks to the community. You and I, when we speak to Allah, we speak in the plural sense. We say, إِيَّاكَ نَعْبُدُ وَإِيَّاكَ نَسْتَعِينَ. And when we say the tashahud, As-salamu alayna, we speak as a community, collectively. Why? Because the religion of Islam has come forward and said that when it comes to seeking the path of success and satisfaction of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, this will not be possible if an individual isolates themselves and thinks about themselves and themselves only. Allah tabaraka wa ta'ala has created us as communities, as tribes, as nations. And one of the more important things that emerged from the life of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far is the need to understand the urgency by which the narrations and before that the Quran speak about when it comes to fulfilling the hajat of your brothers and sisters. Someone comes and asks you to help him or her fulfill something, get something done.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A big sit-in was held inside the Red Cross office in the blockaded Gaza Strip on Monday in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners on hunger strike. On Sunday, scores of Palestinian prisoners started a mass hunger strike to support two of their fellow prisoners who have been on hunger strike for several months to protest their administrative detention. Around 500 Palestinian prisoners are being held without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, while their incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for more than 10 years. Their only recourse to draw attention to their plight has been hunger strikes. Among them, Khalil Awaude has been refusing food since March, and Raed Rayan has adopted the same passive resistance approach since April.
Yesterday, dozens of Palestinian detainees from different factions entered an open-ended hunger strike in solidarity with two Palestinian detainees who are going on their long hunger strike protesting the administrative detention, Khalil Awaude and Raed Rayan.
Currently, some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners are held in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers. Families of Palestinian prisoners have slammed the silence of the international community over the plight of their loved ones.
I want to talk about the silence of the international community and the United Nations. I sent many letters about my son's case to all of them to intervene with the Israeli government to talk with them about my son's case, but unfortunately no response from all of them.
Prisoners' advocacy groups also condemned Israel's treatment of the Palestinian prisoners, who are subjected to inhumane and degrading conditions, including solitary confinement and bans on family visits.
Palestinian detainees nowadays are subjected to inhumane practices by Israeli prison services. Therefore, we are here today to convey a message to the international community, especially to the ICRC, to put pressure on the Israeli government to stop such policies and to end the Palestinian suffering, Palestinian detainees' suffering.
Many here believe that the support Israel enjoys from some countries like the United States gives it the green light to act in contradiction with international law regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Statistics show that the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and minors. Among them, some 50,000 administrative detainees. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Algerian Foreign Minister Ramtane Al-Amamra has met Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in Damascus and handed him a letter from Algerian President on bilateral relations and preparations made for the upcoming Arab League summit in Algeria. Assad said the Arab League is the mirror that reflects Arabs' status quo, asserting what matters to Syria is the content and result of joint Arab action rather than the form. Amamra said Syria is a basic element on the Arab arena and that the Arab world needs Syria, not vice versa. He stressed that Algeria will remain standing beside and coordinating with Syria regarding Arab and international developments during its presidency of the Arab League summit. The top Algerian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart. The two sides agreed to boost economic cooperation and establish a joint higher committee for this purpose. However, the main topic was how to bridge gaps in the relations between Syria and some Arab countries, as Algeria is exerting efforts to bring back Syria to the Arab League.
If you ask Arabs, does Syria have a legitimate seat in the Arab League? The answer would be yes. Is Syria's absence from the Arab League in the benefit of any side? The answer is no. Syria's absence harms joint Arab action. Are there means to solve this situation? This is the core of my consultations with Arab brothers. We are optimistic.
Muqdad asserted that the issue is beyond just attending or not attending the Arab League summit.
We coordinate with Algeria and some Arab countries, regardless of Syria's membership in the Arab League. What is important now is to coordinate policies and come out with conclusions that serve Arab goals. Syria supports all measures that renew Arab stances, solidarity, and an Arab understanding of importance of joint coordination between all of us to face mutual challenges.
Algeria is one of the few Arab countries that remained supportive to Syria during its crisis, as it condemned terror and rejected economic sanctions on Syria.
This is the first official visit of an Algerian foreign minister to Syria in years. It comes as Algeria strives to unite Arab states and enhance Arab-Arab relations ahead of hosting the upcoming Arab League summit in November. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Evidence continues to mount that Europe's sanctions campaign against Russia is exacerbating the euro currency's persistent and perhaps structural economic troubles. France's finance minister just released a depressing outlook. This year's economic growth will be cut almost in half and remain between just 1.4 and 1.8% until at least 2028. The Eurozone's second largest economy now looks too weak to drive what many have long called the world's most unstable macroeconomic bloc.
From 2008 to 2017, the Eurozone's average annual economic growth was just 0.6%. From 2018 through 2021, the growth rate was even worse, just 0.5%, putting the Eurozone on track for a second consecutive lost decade.
Despite the clear failure of austerity policies in producing growth, President Emmanuel Macron will continue with far-right economics in his second term. His finance minister boasted of plans to cut much-needed public spending to a 20-year low, citing a desire to submit to Brussels' entirely arbitrary 3% rule on public deficits.
We're talking about a systemic crisis in Europe, and one which existed before the crisis caused by the pandemic, as well as the crisis caused by the need to find alternative energy sources other than Russia. What it all adds up to is that a state of crisis continuing still.
This week, the new and deeply fractured National Assembly passed the Emergency Purchasing Power Bill, aimed at countering still-rising, once-in-a-generation inflation. At just 20 billion euros, it has been widely criticized as an ineffective and even superficial measure.
For many people, this bill is insufficient in comparison with the scope of the crisis. The same criticism has been made of a government fuel rebate of 18 cents, which began in April. However, it is 20 billion euros which will help the poorest level of society and students deal with the effects of high inflation.
France's government claims that upcoming austerity rollbacks planned for the pension and unemployment system will actually produce broad economic growth this time. The European Central Bank is raising interest rates, even though the eurozone is already on the brink of recession. Sanctions and not diplomacy continues to be the destabilizing Western choice regarding Ukraine. The long-term economic outlook for France and the eurozone appears bleak to many. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Thousands of Palestinians took part in funeral processions of Mohammed Azizi, 25, and Abdurrahman Subh, 28, who were killed early Sunday during an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus and its old town. The Fatah Armed Wing Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade says the two Palestinians were its members, while the Israeli military says the operation in Nablus was launched to apprehend armed suspects. Following the raid, a general strike called across Nablus to mourn the death of the two Palestinians.
The operation this time was more violent than the previous ones. Clashes were heavy as Israeli soldiers raided the neighborhood from all sides. Live ammunitions and rockets were fired towards the houses. I believe such ammunitions are only used in wars between countries.
Israeli forces raided Al-Yasamin neighborhood and surrounded a house, which the regime said Palestinian fighters had barricaded themselves in. Eyewitnesses described the raid as a full-blown military invasion, while the Palestinian Red Crescent reported 19 injuries, including 10 people, hit by live fire. The Palestinian leadership has condemned the operation, with a spokesman of the Palestinian president saying the Israeli crime will not defeat the Palestinians and will not break their will.
It's a barbaric act. It's another crime committed by the Israeli forces. They fired rockets at a house and they knew people were inside it. Two young men were killed and many others were wounded. It's obvious that the entire region will remain in a circle of violence until the occupation ends.
At least 52 Palestinians have been killed since late March, as Israel has intensified its aggression after a wave of deadly anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of Israeli soldiers. The Israeli military has never stopped its raids in the occupied West Bank. Such operations have often led to the death and injury of Palestinians, like what happened in Nablus. Regardless of how many people are killed or injured in the raids, Palestinians say resistance is their only option until they free the occupied territories. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
We all remember her from pictures. At the time that her father was assassinated, Armita Razai Nejad was only 5. Her mother, Shohra Pirani, was also wounded in the attack. Today, her story has found its way on the silver screen, revealing new dimensions of how Dariush Razai Nejad was martyred. What made the ordeal even tougher was the fact that Dariush was shot right in front of his wife and his 5-year-old daughter. The international community, human rights advocates, and even the UN remained silent. This prompted Chora Pirani to write a letter to then-U.S. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, denouncing in the strongest terms the assassination of researchers and scientists. Her move inspired a group of filmmakers to make a movie based on the story.
About 5 or 6 years ago, we decided to make this movie. I believe that as filmmakers, we had a responsibility to do so.
This is a very important part of our contemporary history. It's a story that just had to be told. It should have been done sooner.
I was preoccupied by this incident for years. How can you kill someone right in front of his 5-year-old kid? I did some research, and as soon as the opportunity came up, we decided to make the movie.
Hanas, which literally means breath, is a biopic that dramatizes the story of Dariush Reza'i Nejad, a nuclear scientist that was assassinated in 2011.
This movie is actually a document that shows how Iran has been a victim of terror attacks. There aren't many countries in which such brutal terror attacks have happened. The assassination of a scientist and researcher while his family is watching.
This was a very educational movie showing us the animosity of Israel and the United States.
I found it to be an educational movie, both important and interesting.
I learned a lot. It was very interesting.
The feminine touch has turned this biopic into a must-see, and now, in an open letter, Armita has called on all foreign ambassadors in Iran to watch the movie, too.
In the words of Armita, the daughter of the martyred scientist Dariush Reza'i Nejad, Iranian or non-Iranian, everyone should watch this movie just to catch a glimpse of the atrocities and human rights violations that are committed against the Iranian people, while the international community remains silent. Kisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
South Korean peace activists gathered at Imjingak, a peace park near the border with North Korea, to call for an official declaration to end the 1950-53 Korean War. They also want the agreements made during previous inter-Korean summits to be upheld.
Let's join together, 80 million people for peace. Let's get together, people for peace around the world. Let's start today the great journey of marking the 70th anniversary of the armistice. Next year, the year of the end of the war and the first year of the peace agreement.
Peace activists traveled in groups from across South Korea to join the event. Former President Moon Jae-in had sought engagement with North Korea, but his push for an inter-Korean peace failed to materialize. Participants here want results.
We gathered here because everyone wants to keep a state of peace in the middle of this tension. We hope this will expand and be transmitted to the so-called politicians in South Korea and the world, so that peace can be achieved politically.
We believe that, after all, politicians have some responsibility for the Korean Peninsula issue, but our citizens need to show some of the world's political leaders that the general public wants an end to the Korean War.
The Korean peace appeal seeks 100 million signatures to deliver to the United Nations and the warring parties next year. New South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol is taking a hard line with North Korea, boosting the country's military and strengthening its alliance with the United States, with joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises planned for next month. Advocates for peace, like those gathered here today, have an uphill battle. Frank Smith, South Korea.
A gathering of Lebanese journalists and activists was held in the South Lebanon town of Naqoura to protest against Israel's extraction activities in the disputed waters.
We are so powerful, we can fight, we can go to war in case the enemy wants a war, unless we get our rights and our wealth in the sea and on the land.
Former head of the Lebanese negotiating team told Press TV that any negotiator should use all sources of power in his hands to strengthen their position facing the other party.
One of the strongest points is the resistance and the position of the resistance in the negotiation, or for asking for getting what is right for Lebanon.
The speakers believe that Israeli attempts to drill in disputed waters could escalate the current status quo.
The Lebanese community and the media community is behind the Lebanese negotiation and behind the Lebanese resistance to confirm our right and in our wealth.
Within the presence of the resistance, as well as the army of Lebanon and the people who refuse such aggression, because we believe that this act is already an aggression against Lebanon, and we have all the right to give a response to it, whether it is a legal response or any form, diplomatic or political, or any form of response within our power of nation.
We came here, Lebanese government and people and press, to make the line and the point that this is our land and this is our sea and this is our sky.
Israeli caretaker Minister Yair Lapid has told U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein that he wants to make a deal with Lebanon over the disputed waters as soon as possible. This comes a week after Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah said the resistance is ready for military escalation if Western pressure to prevent Lebanon from extracting its resources continues. Hochstein is expected in Beirut later in July. We are here in Naqoura, the last Lebanese town on Lebanon's south coast. From here, at least three lines have been drawn in efforts to demarcate the maritime borders, all of which remain disputed, and nine both potentially rich in gas and petrol. But Lebanon's president, Michel Aoun, says Western pressure has hampered extraction activities. Mariam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
The notorious Ukrainian website Mirotvorets, meaning peacemaker. It publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old, and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Oles Bazina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Rocelli, an Italian journalist, after he was killed on the front line, the website posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mirotvorets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. Dianis Bitkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass, he's also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have a right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site, and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism. They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. That's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to the Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. But like the old saying is that the others once terrorist is another one's freedom fighter, and hopefully all
sense and truth and peace-loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Millett, Donbass.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the U.S., Mark Shorty was chief of staff of Vice President Mike Pence, and Greg Jacob, a lawyer for Mike Pence, have been subpoenaed in the Justice Department's expanding criminal inquiry. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Alan Feuer and Maggie Haberman. The piece is titled Top Pence aides testified to grand jury in January 6 investigation. Two top aides to former Vice President Mike Pence testified last week to a federal grand jury in Washington investigating the events surrounding the January 6th attack on the Capitol, the highest-ranking officials of the Trump administration so far known to have cooperated with the Justice Department's widening inquiry into the events leading up to the assault on the Capitol. The appearances before the grand jury of the men, Mark Short, who was Mike Pence's chief of staff, and Greg Jacob, who was his counsel, were the latest indication that the Justice Department's criminal investigation into the events surrounding and preceding the riot is intensifying after weeks of growing questions about the urgency the department has put on examining former President Donald J. Trump's potential criminal liability. The testimony of the two Pence aides marked the first time it has become publicly known that figures with first-hand knowledge of what took place inside the White House in the tumultuous days before the attack have cooperated with federal prosecutors. Both Mark Short and Greg Jacob played important roles in describing to a House Select Committee conducting a parallel investigation of the Capitol attack how Donald Trump working with allies like the lawyer John Eastman, mounted a campaign to pressure Mike Pence into disrupting the normal counting of Electoral College votes on 6th of January 2021 as part of an effort to keep Donald Trump in office. Mark Short's testimony was confirmed by two people familiar with it, as was Greg Jacobs. The Justice Department has at times appeared to be lagging behind the House Select Committee, which has spoken to more than 1,000 witnesses, including some from inside the Trump White House. Much of the testimony has been highlighted at a series of public hearings over the past 2 months. It remains unclear precisely what Mark Short and Greg Jacob told the grand jury or what questions prosecutors may have asked them. But both previously gave recorded and transcribed interviews to the House committee, and Mr. Jacob served as a live witness at one of the panel's public hearings that focused on the effort to strong-arm Mike Pence. Mark Short and Greg Jacob were present in the Oval Office for a meeting on 4th of January 2021, at which Donald Trump had John Eastman try to persuade Mike Pence that he could delay or block congressional certification of Mr. Trump's Electoral College defeat. John Eastman's plan relied on Mike Pence being willing to accept, as he presided over a joint session of Congress on 6th of January 2021. That there were disputes over the validity of electors whose votes for Joseph R. Biden Jr. had already been certified by the states, a baseless assertion that had been promoted by a number of Trump allies in the previous weeks as a last-ditch way to help keep Donald Trump in office. Mike Pence ultimately rejected Donald Trump's pressure on him to go along with the plan, but the so-called fake electors proposal has been one of the primary lines of inquiry to have become public in the Justice Department's sprawling investigation. Mark Short also provided the House committee with testimony that highlighted the sense of threat that built from Donald Trump's efforts to derail the congressional proceedings on 6th of January 2021. He told the House committee how he had informed Mr. Pence's lead Secret Service agent on 5th of January 2021 that Donald Trump was about to publicly turn on Mike Pence over his refusal to go along with the electors' plan, potentially placing a target on his former boss's back. On 6th of January 2021, some members of the mob of Trump supporters that attacked the Capitol chanted, "Hang Mike Pence." Donald Trump reacted approvingly to the chants, effectively saying that Mike Pence deserved it, according to testimony collected by the House committee. Mark Short's testimony to the federal grand jury was reported earlier by ABC News. Greg Jacobs' testimony was reported earlier by the Wall Street Journal. Until now, the only other pro-Trump figure, aside from rioters who were at the Capitol, known to have testified in front of a federal grand jury investigating January 6, was the prominent Stop the Steal organizer, Ali Alexander. Mr. Alexander, acting on a subpoena from prosecutors, answered questions in front of the grand jury for about 3 hours in late June. Prosecutors have also issued grand jury subpoenas to several people connected to the scheme to create false slates of electors, saying that Mr. Trump won the 2020 presidential election in swing states that were actually won by Joseph Biden Jr. Those who have received the subpoenas have largely been state lawmakers or Republican officials, many of whom put their names on documents attesting to the fact that they were electors for Donald Trump. The subpoena, some of which have been obtained by the New York Times, showed that prosecutors are interested in collecting information on a group of pro-Trump lawyers who helped to devise and carry out the plan. Among the lawyers named in the subpoenas are Rudolf Giuliani, who helped oversee Donald Trump's challenges to the election, and John Eastman, an outside lawyer who drafted several memos encouraging Donald Trump to use the fake electors as part of the campaign to pressure Mike Pence to throw him the election. Last month, federal agents stopped John Eastman outside a restaurant in New Mexico and seized his cell phone. On that same day, agents also seized electronic devices from another lawyer involved in the fake electoral scheme, Jeffrey Clark. Mr. Clark, a former Justice Department official, helped draft a letter to state officials in Georgia falsely stating that the department had evidence of election fraud in the state. If the grand jury testimony of Mark Short and Greg Jacob echoed their interviews with the House committee, it suggests that prosecutors have likely homed in on how Donald Trump and his allies sought to pressure Mike Pence into ignoring or refusing to accept some states of electors as he oversaw the final certification of the election. The effort to pressure Mike Pence into derailing certification of the Electoral College results was the chief focus of one of the House committee's hearings in June. The panel provided evidence at the hearing that Donald Trump went along with the scheme despite having been told it was illegal. At the hearing, the House committee played videotape testimony in which Greg Jacob said that John Eastman had admitted in front of Donald Trump at the January 4th meeting, 2 days before the riot, that his plan to have Mike Pence obstruct the electoral certification violated the Electoral Count Act. Greg Jacob testified to the committee that Mike Pence knew early on that the plan was unlawful. Mr. Pence's first reaction upon hearing of it, Greg Jacob said, was that there was no way this was justifiable. The pressure campaign against Mike Pence by Donald Trump and John Eastman also played a central role in a court decision this spring by a federal judge in California who said that Donald Trump and John Eastman had most likely committed federal crimes, such as obstruction of a congressional proceeding and conspiracy to defraud the United States. In the decision, which emerged from John Eastman's attempts to stop the House panel from gaining access to his emails, the judge, David Carter, noted that Donald Trump had facilitated 2 meetings in the days before the January 6th riot that were explicitly tied to persuading Vice President Pence to disrupt the joint session of Congress. At the first meeting on 4th of January, Donald Trump and John Eastman invited Mike Pence, Mark Short and Greg Jacob to the Oval Office. There, Judge Carter wrote, John Eastman presented his plan to Vice President Mike Pence, focusing on either rejecting electors or delaying the count. That meeting was followed by another, Judge Carter wrote, on 5th of January 2021, during which John Eastman sought again to persuade Greg Jacob to go along with the scheme. Dr. Eastman and President Trump launched a campaign to overturn a Democratic election, an action unprecedented in American history, Judge David Carter wrote.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile.
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi.
Shahid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr.
He was born in Kadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmoud Shahrudi was.
When we look at the works of late Rawzati, we see.
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid.
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. This is the teacher, an analysis on the thoughts and works of the most outstanding Muslim Shiite scholars. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Mahdavi and Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakh Rouhani, a faculty member of the University of Qom. Sheikh Mahdavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Dr. Fakh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
So, Sayyid Ahmad Khansari, one of the most outstanding contemporary Shiite Maraja and Fuqaha, is the person with whom we are mainly concerned, a person who was known for his righteousness, his level of the knowledge, his simple life, his high spiritual status, we can say, and he produced so many outstanding scholars and ulama for the next generation, Sayyid Ahmad Khansari. Sheikh Mahdavi, let's start with you, brother. Give us some details about the early life of Sayyid Ahmad Khansari.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khansari. Born in 1887, and it's good to know that he lived till 1985, almost 100 years he lived. He had a long life. He experienced different occasions, and his life is full of incidents, scholarly incidents, social, political incidents that inshallah we will deal with in our program. As you mentioned, he is regarded as one of the great ulama who benefited from the great asatid,
yes,
of the Hawza, namely Akhund Khurasani, Sayyid Muhammad Kazim Tabatabai Yazdi, who is the Sahib Urve.
Yes.
Maybe our audience are familiar with the title of Al Urwatul Wuthqa,
yes,
a very famous Ahkam book. And also he benefited from the presence of Mirza Naini and Agha Ziya-e-Araqi. He is regarded as the latest students of Akhund Khurasani. He lived from among the late,
yes,
circles of his students.
In fact, he benefited from both the generation of Akhund Khurasani and also the students of Akhund Khurasani, like Agha Ziya-e-Araqi,
yeah,
we can say, and Mirza Naini. Okay?
Yeah, and it is said that he assumed or attained the status of Marja'iyya after Ayatollah Burujerdi. And also, when we look at his biography, something rare, I mean,
mm-hmm,
in comparison to the lifestyle of the ulama of that time, happened that we see a marja who lives his scholarly life and move to Tehran,
yes,
and take over the masjid, which is located in the bazaar.
Yes.
Yes.
That's right.
So it was out of the request of the merchants of the bazaar of Tehran who went to Ayatollah Burujerdi and asked for a good spiritual imam who can lead, mm-hmm, their salat in the masjid of Bazaar. And Ayatollah Burujerdi asked Sayyid Ahmad Khansari to come and take over the all affairs of that masjid, and he stayed there.
That's
while
right.
He was also marja, he stayed there. Usually at that time, most of the maraja would leave in Qom because of the spiritual atmosphere of Qom. They would prefer to stay in Qom, but we see he had more important concern in his life, and he wouldn't,
that's right,
pay attention to these affairs. Maybe, as you said, he was,
yes,
really down-to-earth marja, not,
yes,
giving much attention to some customs,
yes,
that are just playing around this lifestyle of the maraja. So he was, as you said, very pious, very,
mm-hmm,
famous as his piety, simple life.
Yes.
And when we look at his life, while he was in Tehran, we can see some sort of opposition against the Shah or Pahlavi government at that time,
okay,
specifically during the White Revolution.
Yes.
and during the events which took place in 5 June in,
that's right.
Yes, in okay. the Hauza Elmi of Qom. This is his opposition against the Shah's government.
We will get to more details about the socio-political life too, but what is outstanding about the life of Sayyid Ahmad Khansari is his stay in Tehran. Dr. Fakhrani, maybe so many of our dear listeners do not know that Tehran was also famous for having outstanding scholars and producing outstanding scholars out of the seminary or seminary-like schools in Tehran, in Hauza of Tehran, isn't it?
Yes, yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the beginning, it must be indicated that Tehran was famous, for having its own Shia seminary, great Shia seminary, such that, even today, the Tehran School of Shia Studies is very famous because of its trends in fiqh usul as well as in philosophy and Islamic doctrinal topics.
Yes.
Well, since Tehran has been the capital of Iran right from the Qajar period up to now, and at the same time, many efforts used to be done on westernization of Tehran, it was necessary for Tehran to have, high-ranking Shia dignitary at the level of Marja'iyya. And because of this, we find that many outstanding merchants of Tehran Bazaar
yes.
Requested the late great Ayatollah Burujerdi to introduce to them one of his confident disciples and, people. Then the late great Ayatollah Burujerdi introduced the late Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khansari.
That's right.
What's known in this regard is that prior to going, before migrating to Tehran, the late Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khansari was one of the important candidates. He was supposed to be one of the successors to Ayatollah Burujerdi in Qom. However, because of his migration to Tehran, and because it was necessary, to supervise the doctrinal and religious atmosphere of Tehran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khansari preferred to stay in Tehran, and his stay in Tehran was also a very important point and important episode in the Tehran Shia Seminary.
That's right.
He started teaching over there, and in fact he continued some of the lessons that he used to teach in Qom.
Yes.
And some of his Qom students and disciples later on, they also settled in Tehran.
That's right.
And they continued attending his lessons and lectures over there. So you find that,
So usually the people who wanted to be successor to a great Marja'i al-Am must yes. reside in Najaf or Qom.
Yes.
But because Ayatollah Khansari was in Tehran and felt the responsibility of nurturing
yes.
the religious atmosphere and the schools over there,
yes.
he in fact, left this position
yes.
and did not become the Marja'i al-Am. But he was a Marja'i Taqlid, wasn't he?
Yes, yes. Yeah. He was certainly a Marja'i Taqlid.
Okay.
And in this way, one may say that, he sacrificed, his position as a Marja'i yes. Taqlid in Qom or in Najaf and yes. preferred to go to Tehran.
Mm-hmm.
But it wouldn't make any difference in his case because of his academic caliber and academic, yes. Profundity, that academic and doctrinal profundity, that he remained a Marja'i Taqlid even in Tehran.
That's
and
right.
he proved very much influential in Tehran.
Okay, Sheikh Mahtavi, beside all this scholarly life, most of the, contemporary generation of Shiite mystics and Urafa and spiritual trainers consider Sayyid Ahmad Khansari as a person of high spiritual, status, a person who, as according to so many of the scholars say, was on both aspects perfect. The scholar life, the jurisprudential life, and the mystical life. Can you give us some details about this aspect, the spiritual power and talents of the late Sayyid Ahmad Khansari?
Okay, this is a very good point to mention about his lifestyle. I think we have to talk about this point and elaborate on this point that when we talk about the spirituality and the spiritual lifestyle of a marja, Most of the audience or people who are listening to our lecture might expect us to say something about the supernaturality or some superhuman power that they had. They did something extraordinary, but this is not in fact the case. As we have a very famous statement from Ayatollah Behjat, maybe I am not that correct with the wording, but this is a concept that he has mentioned that, or it is mentioned regarding Ayatollah Behjat, that one of the great thing about his spiritual life, that he was a great abd or servant to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, alongside all these supernatural stories that being said here and there. So most of the things that we have to pay attention is their lifestyle and their relationship with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Also for Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khansari, when we are talking about his spiritual lifestyle, we have to consider this point that this is not a good character to only focus on such aspect of his life, although there are some points which are narrated. For example, that is a very famous story regarding him when he had to undertake a surgery because of the medical conditions and situation that he was suffering from. So doctors and physicians said that for some hours you must go in the state of anesthesia.
Yes.
Yeah. So,
in fact, you lose your consciousness during the surgery. Okay.
Yes, you are losing your senses. But because of his opinion in fiqh and sharia, that he was of this opinion that when a marja goes under this state, his follower may lose their connection with the marja, and they have to reintend their marja as their marja for the rest of their life. He said, okay, I don't want to go under this state of anesthesia. But doctor said, how is that possible? We are going to cut your body, do this, do that. He said, okay, don't worry about it. The moment I started reciting the surah An'am, you start your job and don't worry about my feeling. I'm not going to feel anything. It shows the level of his concentration. The moment he wants to do something, he wants to distract himself from all these physical world, he can, and he did it. He started reciting the Surah An'am, and it is narrated not only in his biography. Many ulama are saying this story. It's famous with this great scholar. And he didn't accept to go in the state of anesthesia.
Yes.
And this is also good to know, because nowadays this thing might happen for many of the maraja, since they may go to the doctor, they might have some surgery. It was his exclusive fatwa that the connection of marja and the followers may cut off when the marja goes under this state.
Yes,
the followers and muqalladin.
Yes.
As it is asked from Ayatollah Makarem, how if a marja nowadays goes under this, should we re-intend our intention of following you? He said, no, it is not. As I said, because of the issue of fatwa, some of the maraja might have different fatwas, but it was his exclusive fatwa, and he acted upon his fatwa.
Yes.
He kept his relationship and connection to the followers.
And it shows his the purity of the soul.
Definitely.
And his sincerity and ikhlas in doing so, you know, how much they were, we can say, careful and attentive to points in their religious and spiritual life. Up to an extent that for doing a surgery, they will not lose this connection between themselves and the muqalladin. That's all right. His most outstanding work is Jamul Madarik fi Sharh al Mukhtasar al Nafi, Dr. Fakhruhani.
Yes.
Just give us a little bit details about this work of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad al Khansari. What is
this for? Actually, it has been a good practice in Shia seminaries, whether in India, in Pakistan, in Iraq, or in Iran, elsewhere, even in Lebanon, that when a great dignitary publishes a very important book, in fact, I mean, to some degree, a seminal book, some of, other later generation ulama come and explain or elucidate certain aspects of this great book.
Yes.
Likewise, we find that so many books have been written on Kifayat al-Usul Akhund Khorasani or Urwat al-Wasqai, the late Ayatollah Tabatabai Yazdi.
Yes, that's right. Okay.
The same holds true regarding Al-Mukhtasar al-Nafi' of the late Muhaqqiq Hilli. Muhaqqiq Hilli was an outstanding Shia faqih, and he was a nephew of the late Sheikh Atusi.
Yes.
The late great Ayatollah Sayyid Ahmad Khonsari compiled a book, developed a book entitled Jamal Madarek, and he devoted it to elucidation of the points and fiqh argumentations of the late Muhaqqiq Hilli.
That's right. Okay.
It must be indicated that, this book took this Ayatollah around 30 years, and it indicates that he was very meticulous in analyzing everything that could be found and could be incorporated in the book.
That's all right.
Please note carefully that at the time when that book was going to be published, written, present-day facilities like, for example, internet services or CD-ROMs or other things were not available. And one had to check all books, page by page, even line by line, in order to come up with the evidence.
That's all right.
Of course, he produced other books, mainly concerned with Shia doctrinal topics or, for example, his own exposition of Al-Urwat al-Wasqa, and also some other books regarding Hajj rituals.
That's all right. Thank you much, Shaykh Fakhruhani and Shaykh Mahdavi, for a nice elaboration regarding the scholarly life and the spiritual life of Sayyid Ahmad Khonsari, one of the greatest ulama in contemporary Iran. In the year 1405, according to the lunar Hajj calendar, Sayyid Ahmad al-Khonsari passed away in the city of Tehran. His body was taken into the city of Qom, and he was buried in Masjid al-Balasar in vicinity of the tomb of Lady Fatima al-Masuma in the holy city of Qom. And Imam Khomeini gave a message of condolence on his demise. They can find it on Sahifat al-Imam, volume 19, page 128. He talks about the great attributes of Sayyid Ahmad al-Khonsari, his fruitful life, and what he did for the houses of the Shiite world. The message of condolences by the late Imam Khomeini. May Allah bless the soul of this outstanding man, Sayyid Ahmad al-Khonsari. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program The Teacher on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio.
Coming up is the news.